Well, good morning. Grace to you and peace be multiplied through Jesus Christ our Lord. It is a delight to be with you once again. And thank you so much for the hospitality you extended to us, the opportunity to talk together, to be together, and to raise some very valid questions. Last summer, Shalom, a young girl, late teenager, early 20s girl from our church, went on a mission trip to Dominican Republic through the water program with Sharon Mennonite Bible Institute, SMBI. Their main group was comprised of 10 people. There were 5 youth, 2 staff women, and a staff couple with a baby boy. At one point during their time together, they decided to take part of a day and go to do a little sightseeing and see some waterfalls. They hiked to the top of the falls, and upon arriving at the top, some of the young people noticed that it was narrow enough, the stream was narrow enough at the top that they could jump across to the other side and get a different view of the falls and the scenery surrounding that area. It was maybe a 4-foot jump or so. It was a jump over fast-flowing water, but those who decided to do it, 5 of them decided to do that, all landed safely on the other side. However, when they decided to come back, they realized that the rock was a little higher on the other side than they had remembered, and there was moss on the rock. And that presented a bit more of a challenge than they had thought about when they crossed the first time. And so there were 2 guys and 3 girls that had crossed over, and the first guy jumped across. He was fine. The 3 girls that were there sort of jokingly suggested that the other fellow jump across and then be stationed to help them in case anything unexpected happened. And so Shalom and another girl jumped across safely. The 3rd girl, as she jumped, something happened and she began to slip. And Justin, the boy who was stationed on the rock, reached out to help her. And in the process of all the events, not sure how it all happened, the girl was able to scramble to safety, but Justin was pulled into the current of the water and was immediately taken down toward the edge of the falls. There was nothing he could do. It was only about a 10-foot length of space there, but about a 40 to 50-foot drop of falls. So inexplicably, Justin found some sort of something that stopped him at the very edge of the falls. The girls, of course, screamed and covered their eyes and weren't sure what to do. Justin found a way to work himself toward a crevice just a little bit upstream, upcurrent, where he could stand a little more securely. He felt that if he could take off his shoes, he would have more grip with his feet. And as he did that, however, the current again swept him to the very edge of the falls, and again, inexplicably, he found something to stop him. Again, he worked himself back to that crevice. But he was in a very difficult position. He could not reach the steep bank to his left. There was no way to keep going further upstream against the current, and the constant pressure was continually threatening to dash him over the edge to the rocks 40 to 50 feet below. There was nothing that Justin could do to combat that current. I plan to share with you the rest of that story further on in this message. I hope that you're feeling a bit of the tension and pressure that Justin was facing, as well as the group that he was with. I hope you're feeling that because the reality is that each of the cultures in which we find ourselves has a current. Culture is on the move. Culture is going somewhere. The title of the message this morning is Culture is Current. Culture is current. And naturally, I mean this in at least 2 senses of that word, both in the sense of belonging to the present time. Culture is always current. The cultures in which we find ourselves. But especially that second definition of something that is running or flowing or going somewhere. Every one of us, brothers and sisters, are swimming in cultural waters. It's likely we find ourselves in multiple different cultural waters in the course of a week. And that's not necessarily the danger. I'm confident that most of us here this morning are building upon the rock of salvation, Christ Jesus. We have a sense of security, a sense of stability, a sense of true hope because we are covered by the blood of the Lamb. We are trusting in Him. But it is possible that we might forget that cultures have currents. Every culture is going somewhere. Every culture is leading to its vision of the good life, whatever that vision is. And of course, most cultures are leading away from God, away from safety, away from the rock of our salvation. I want you to know that cultures have currents. They're going somewhere, and so are you. Our text today is found in Ephesians chapter 2, a fairly well-known text, no doubt, and yet a very important one. In the first message of our time together this weekend, we talked about the fact that culture is consequential. It affects change. It has great meaning. It causes things to happen. In the second message, we highlighted the fact that culture compounds. Not only is it made up of various entities, but in itself, as a group of people live together, in good ways and even bad ways, there is a compounding of cultural interest. As a compounding entity, we have the opportunity to leverage or to squander cultural capital. Today, we're considering the power of culture to move us and how, Lord willing, to resist it. In Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1, this is from the New King James Version, Paul says, "And you, he, Christ, made alive, who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others." We once walked according to the course of this world. If we are going to survive and thrive the swirling currents in which we find ourselves, whether it's this age or any age, really, it will require us, I believe, to sustain and generate strong countercultural currents. Overcoming and overpowering current cultural currents will demand a number of things from us. First of all, I believe a vital step is simply seeing the current. Seeing the current. We've talked a fair bit this weekend about how so much of culture tends to be made up of invisible elements, at least invisible to the physical eye. Since culture is made up of, quote, shared attitudes, values, goals, and practices, except for the practices part, the other elements tend to be below the waterline and largely unthought about. And yet, visible or not, culture is most definitely a force with which to be reckoned. Whether Christian or non-Christian, every person is subject to the moving force of cultures. The main reason why I chose Ephesians 2 for our text is what I appreciate here, the wisdom of Paul in verse 2, where he notes that Jesus made us spiritually alive and we walked, that before he did, before Christ made us alive, we walked according to the course of this world. Do any of you have a Spanish Bible here? What does it say in the Spanish, Brother Duane?
Which verse?
In verse 2.
You want me to read the whole verse?
Sure. Gracias. The word that Brother Duane read for course there, what was that word, brother, in the Spanish? Was it corriente?
Corriente.
What does the word corriente mean? It gives the idea of current. Before Christ made us alive, we tended to go with the currents of the world in our life and our lifestyle. In both the natural and supernatural realms, there are currents for us to contend with. We can consider the fact of current. We look at the natural world, we recognize that there are water currents, there are air currents, there are electrical currents, and probably other ones that I'm not thinking about. By and large, these are things that we cannot see, yet can be very powerful, both beneficially good for us and detrimental as well. Different times, as I've sensed the winds blowing through our area, and you have winds as well, I think of them, as Dr. Josh Axe says, as the great scrubbers of the earth, God's great cleaners or cleansers of the air. The winds that God sends to us are a very helpful and beautiful thing. But we also know that they can cause a lot of destruction as well. So there are multiple invisible currents in the natural world. The fact of current, we recognize the force of current. Even though we go through life not giving much thought to these, should we find ourselves touching an electrical wire that is coursing with voltage, we will soon let it go, if indeed we're able to do so. And like Justin, there are moments when our eyes are open to the real power that these entities represent, the force of current. And we can also think, of course, about the fate of current. These currents are going somewhere. They are traveling. They're not static. Culture is not static. Contrary to what a lot of young people tend to think, the church is not interested in freeze-framing certain things. We are interested in navigating. That's what we have to do. Even if you tried to freeze frame something, it's not going to stay exactly the same. But we must be aware of the great power and direction where these influences are going. Sometimes I've thought to myself, it'd be so helpful if we could inject a black dye, or if God would, that would just show us, you know, all the negative elements of currents, in the cultural currents. And we could just see that black smoke. Oh, yeah, that's a bad one there. Popularity and envy and covetousness. And then if he would also include a white, maybe a steam, that would identify all the good currents. You say, oh, yeah, that's a good one. We're going to tap into that one. Be a lot easier to see those things, wouldn't it? Well, I think there's value in thinking about making the currents visible as much as possible, to get a sense of what is happening around us and how it is influencing us, and to help people who are trapped in cultural currents. One of the buzz phrases in the broader church world over the decades has been, engage the culture, engaging the culture. And that's not a bad desire. There's a good hope there to potentially engage the culture. I'm drawing very heavily from Andy Crouch's book, Culture Making, with these thoughts now that I share with you. He gives four ways in which evangelicals, and I would say we as Anabaptists as well, have tended to try to engage culture. We've tried to a lesser or greater extent with the various four that he lists here. The first one he mentions is condemning culture, wagging the finger, loudly denouncing, closing the door. I think that as conservative Christians, it's easy for us to develop a negative stance toward, quote, the world out there. And I want us to be careful about that in our preaching, in our teaching, in our talking with our children, that we not just always default to the negative stance. I'm all for couching things in negative terms. We need to do that sometimes. But to make that an entire way of life will not be helpful in the long run. That has been an evangelical stance, to condemn the culture for the various things that definitely are wrong and are wicked. A second option is to critique the culture. Critique the culture. Analyze it. Look at the movies. Listen to the music. Consider the lyrics. What are people trying to say by the things that they are offering to the broader culture? What does this mean? What deeper desire does it tap into? This has given rise to things like worldview academies, perhaps something like these culture talks. But analyzing, trying to think through, critiquing what this is all about. A third option that I hope we've engaged in less, but has happened in the broader church world, is copying culture. Copying culture. Taking those things that we think are really pretty interesting or amazing and trying to do our own thing that's very similar. I think of contemporary Christian music. Trying to do what the world's doing, but let's give it the better lyrics. I think of things like Christian movies, so-called. Taking and adopting certain phrases. Got Jesus? So that is one way of interacting with or seeking to engage culture. And then a fourth way is consuming culture. Consuming culture. And this one isn't necessarily engaging. It's simply capitulating. It's giving in. It's saying, well, it's there. I might as well look at it. I might as well listen to it. I might as well go along with it. And as Crouch points out, there are several handicaps with these four methods of engaging the culture. The one handicap is that they don't really cause the Christian to do or live any differently than he did before. There's very little effect on the condemner or the critiquer. And there are definite negative effects on the copier and the consumer. So when you look at the net result of engaging the culture in these ways, it doesn't really amount to a whole lot of helpfulness. They don't actually really do much about the culture or even necessarily about the person who is engaging in this way. And that is because, as Crouch notes, no culture experiences itself as thin or incomplete. Maybe one of the values of trying to engage culture is that it does help people to see some of the current. So I'm not completely downplaying all of those four attempts, well, at least not the first two, in engaging culture. But it does not really affect much change on the current or in the person who is stuck in the current. So seeing the current is a very important thing. Seeing the current is important. I think we need to move to a second mindset, though, and that is standing in the current. Standing in the current. There's a sense in which we really cannot escape all the various currents in which we tend to find ourselves in the course of a week. And so we must take a stand within them. In his very well-known prayer in John 17:15, Jesus said, "I do not pray that you should take them out of the world or out of the current, but that you should keep them from the evil one." And furthermore, in Ephesians 6:13 in the NIV, Paul counsels, "Therefore, put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you have done everything, to stand." Stand. There's value in being able to stand in the current. How do we do that? How do we take a stand in the midst of the swirling waters? I think there are a number of rules of cultural engagement, you might say. One of those is to consider the actualities or the realities of life. And the biggest one, which was addressed this morning in our Sunday school class, perhaps yours as well, is the whole matter of there being two kingdoms. If we get fuzzy and uncertain about the two kingdoms, a lot of other things begin to seem plausible. It's why I struggled, as I did, as a pastor, understanding things like nonconformity and non-resistance. Once I got a hold of the two-kingdom reality, the actuality of two kingdoms, those other things snapped into focus and became very clear to me. And so those of you who are being raised with this mindset, don't take it for granted. Get a hold of it and appreciate it for the reality that it is. There are only two kingdoms, and we must reckon with this reality, this cultural reality. I think it's very important for us to live it out in bodily form. What might seem arbitrary or as rules for no good reason, just pulled out of thin air, are not arbitrary or for no good reason at all. They are embodied ways of living that cultivate within us the reality that there are indeed two kingdoms. This is required, I believe, if we're going to stand strong in the midst of various cultural currents. This is full body, whole person combat. There are several attitudes that I think we ought to cultivate in order to stand strong. One of those is humility. I think this has been probably the greatest secret weapon of the Anabaptist people. The cultivation of yieldedness, the German word Gelassenheit, submission. In a conceited and proud age, we will find the power to stand by cultivating and maintaining an attitude of yieldedness and selflessness. One of the reasons that plainness is so important is because it strikes at the root of pride, which is the root, of course, of every other sin, and is the great challenge of this age. Humility. Another attitude to cultivate is honor. In an age that disregards and discards authority, to cultivate and instill within our children and to model for them a willingness to be submissive to authority is very vital. And we do have the responsibility to consider our present actions in the light of our forefathers, those who came before us. Not that we are entirely beholden to completely copy them, but we must take seriously the stand that they took and why they took the way that they did. Honor. And then a third attitude to cultivate is hope. In an age that tends towards cynicism and despair, we have the opportunity to paint the picture and to present it in bodily form as a congregation, a picture of a kingdom that overcomes, a people who are not swayed and moved about by the currents of culture. We have a king that keeps us strong. So we think of the actualities, we think of the attitudes, we also think of actions. You as young people are all about action. Typically, you do rest sometimes. But you want to get stuff done. You want to see things happen. You want to be a part of something that has a future. That's a great thing. I commend you in that. You have the energy. You have the stamina. You have the hope to see things get better. What's important for you to know is that there's a very important way for you to see this happen that will be the most enduring and lasting opportunity for change. We talked about Crouch's observations that condemning and critiquing, consuming and copying don't necessarily move the needle at all in cultural engagement. But he does present two other options that are very important for us if indeed we are going to stand within these currents. The first one is to cultivate godly culture. I think that this is something that young people, but even a lot of us older people, have a hard time doing. This has to do with building appreciation for the past. History lesson. No, please not. Appreciation for our roots. Someone said that for most people today, in the culture today, their history starts at the day they were born. Pretty short history, isn't it? The problem is, as the adage says, the further back you can see, the further forward you can look. And so that means that the current generation overall tends to be fairly short-sighted. A problem with cultivating culture is that it feels so passive. It feels like, I'm tending my great-grandpa's garden. Woohoo. But that's not exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about becoming people of substance through learning to appreciate things that have come before us, by stewarding them, by taking care of them. This is where godly tradition and traditions help to form a certain character and virtue within us if we are receptive to them. There's a book I've really enjoyed called Love What Lasts by Joshua Gibbs. Anybody familiar with this book at all? Oh, good. I love to recommend these books to people who have never seen them before. Joshua Gibbs, I'll just give the caveat for him. He's Greek Orthodox, so take that with a grain of salt. He teaches in a high school. It's an academy that uses classical education as their pedagogical approach for teaching children. But this book, Love What Lasts, the subtitle is How to Save Your Soul from Mediocrity, has some excellent thoughts. He has a quote from Gustav Mahler who said, "Tradition is not the worship of ashes, but the preservation of fire." Tradition is not the worship of ashes, but the preservation of fire. Later on, Gibbs says, "Though traditionalists often speak appreciatively of the past, they are not terribly interested in any particular time. In fact, the opposite is true. Traditionalists are interested in that which has transcended time. That a distant golden age is distant means that it has not lasted, which means it wasn't golden in the first place. Tradition is not the worship of ashes, and so the traditionalist is content for mankind to collectively decide not to pass on certain books, symphonies, plays, and structures to their children. When bulldozers move in to demolish a football stadium built in the 1980s, no traditionalist heroically stands in the way. Neither do traditionalists oppose buying new socks or replacing chip plates and saucers. Traditionalists favor what has lasted, not what happens to be around. Traditionalists prize things that last simply because most things don't. And when something does not last, they know that it is usually the thing's fault." So cultivation is a necessary first step for developing anything of value. Even most of your musicians who are out there coming up with all sorts of music that we would not appreciate, a lot of them have studied basic music theory and have an understanding of how good music is supposed to operate. They've cultivated something. Now, they've taken that and misused it, of course. But cultivation is foundational for engaging and creating culture. Now, of course, we don't want to just simply survive in culture. We don't want to just spend our days cultivating and tending to what is worth passing on. We want to do more than that. So we can see the current, we can stand in the current, but we also want to stride through the current. We don't walk through it. We want to know that we can make some definite headway. And so once we have cultivated and curated the beautiful things that are available to us of previous godly culture, then we are in good shape to do what we all, I think, get excited about, and that is the sixth way, and probably most fulfilling, I don't know, way of engaging culture, and that is creating culture. creating culture. Of the various postures toward culture, Crouch notes that cultivating and creating are the two positive, productive options open to Christians. So while cultivation must precede creation for us to survive, nobody can start from scratch and be enduring. Creation must succeed cultivation for us to thrive. As we work with the basic materials that have been given to us, handed on to us, we can do something positive and life-saving with them. We can reach out to people who are simply struggling to stand in the current. And this brings us back to Justin, who's hanging on for dear life, hoping that the current does not sweep him over the edge of the falls. The girls screamed. They didn't know what to do. They turned their backs. They began to pray fervently. There were three men on the bank who were left to decide what their options might be. The bank was very steep with rocks and branches, and two of the men decided to scramble down and get as close as they could to where Justin was. They were still 15 to 20 feet away from where he was at. The two guys that were working together on this project thought that they could take off their shirts and use those to make a rope, but they were afraid that the current was so strong that that rope, quote-unquote, would tear. And so Justin was able to actually contribute his shirt as well, toss it to the bank. Again, the girls' backs are turned praying fervently. The guys decide they need to take off their pants as well and their belts. And they wove the shirts and belts and pants together to form as strong a rope as they knew how. They were cultivating culture and they were creating something new. And one of the men, the married man actually, shinnied out as far as he could on a rock and tossed that makeshift rope to Justin and was able to pull him to safety at the shore. And the men quickly redressed and scrambled up the bank, and when the girls turned around to see what was happening, the boys were already fully clothed and pretty much up to where they were at, where they had been praying. You know, both of those elements were very important. Praying like they had never prayed before. Prayer is vital. And then acting on those prayers to fashion something of a life-saving device. It's clear that both of those things were brought into effect by the young people, that cultivation and that creation. As Crouch notes, people who consider themselves stewards of culture, guardians of what is best in a neighborhood, an institution, or a field of cultural practice, they gain the respect of their peers. Even more so, those who go beyond being mere custodians to creating new cultural goods are the ones who have the world's attention. Indeed, they carry an outsized weight, so that when they do engage in condemning or critiquing, their voice can actually be heard, because the broader culture can see that they have been cultivating and creating something of true substance and value. What will it take to not just stand, but to walk through the tensions and pressures that we face? I'd like to share with you a list that is non-exhaustive. I'm sure that you could add to it, but these are thoughts that have come to my mind. First of all, the underappreciated practices. The underappreciated practices. Practices, the things that we do in our bodies, with our bodies, habitually, as a group, every Sunday, coming to church, sitting in the pew, perhaps kneeling together as a congregation, perhaps standing, picking up a physical songbook, reading, singing together. The group culture that develops, the power that has, is fourfold. The practices in our bodies inform, they form, they conform, and they transform. Now, we're probably fairly familiar with the informative and the conformative aspects. Oh, yeah, we all have to look the same. Have to wear the same color shirt or a similar. All have to wear plain colored clothes, material. We've heard about the informing part. It informs others of who we are. Yeah, we're separated. It forms us of who we are. Yeah, I'm a different person. But I think we should reckon with those other two aspects as well. Because the formative power of our practices, as Justin Whitman early says in his book, The Common Rule, when I kneel to pray, that tells my body something serious is going on here. And if you're unable to kneel because of a physical issue, I'm not de-Christianizing you in the least, okay? What I'm saying is that what we do with our bodies has a way of influencing us in the entire person and forming within us a certain attitude. Kneeling is a posture of humility. So that formative power. And then the transformative power, where it takes our sensibilities. And as you have that chart before you, if you've taken one from the podium in the back, it talks about how those two different cultures, pop culture versus traditional culture, one of them leaves us where it found us. The other one transforms our sensibilities. And as we go through life, we realize, you know what? I'm a part of something even bigger than I could have imagined. And I have appetites that have been formed and shaped into something bigger than I could have expected. We talked about thick practices and thin practices. In his book, Desiring the Kingdom by James K.A. Smith, how many of you are familiar with this book? Three? Four, five? Good. He has a popular version called You Are What You Love, which has similar material, but some new stuff as well. He says that if we mistakenly think that certain habits or practices are neutral or even thin, when they're actually quite thick and loaded, then we will be unwittingly subjecting ourselves to a formation of our desire that is pointed away from the kingdom of God. So it's really good to think about that. What does it mean for me to carry my cell phone with me everywhere I go? Does it change how I think about life if I bring it into the sanctuary? What does it mean, and I'm not trying to pick on you at all, what does it mean to move from a cap covering with strings to a veil? From a veil to a doily? What does it mean to move from plain colored shirts to shirts with patterns? Is that a thin practice or is that a thick practice? It might be one or the other, but we dare not get those two mixed up lest we give away something that actually is very formative in our lives. Underappreciated practices. Another important thing to consider as we seek to stride through the current, so to speak, is undeveloped principles. Undeveloped principles. There's a number that come to my mind here. The principle of identity. The principle of identity. You are not primarily a thinker, a believer, or a doer. Although as good Anabaptists, we're all doers. We're not primarily any of those. We are primarily lovers. We are lovers. And the thick practices that influence or direct our loves hugely affect and shape our identity. They are pointing our love in a certain direction. The principle of identity. Secondly, the principle of incarnation. What you cease to behave, you eventually cease to believe. There's a school of thought out there that says, you know what? The practices are unimportant. As long as we have the principle, that's what matters. The principle is what matters. That happened in the church, the denomination that I was a part of, in the Brethren in Christ. In their articles of faith, they had a section about the head covering and feet washing and communion. And even the Holy Kiss. But I guarantee you that three of those four were not practiced by 99.9% of the Brethren in Christ denomination in America. They had the principles. They even had a little section about the practice. What you cease to behave, you will soon cease to believe. Lived history proves over and over that practice and principle go together. To discard the practice is to discount the principle and eventually drop it completely. Thirdly, the principle of imitation. Who you imitate is who you become. James K. Smith says, in our culture that prizes authenticity and places a premium on novelty and uniqueness, imitation has received a bad rap, as if being an imitator is synonymous with being a fake. Think, he says, imitation leather. But the New Testament holds imitation in a very different light. Indeed, we are exhorted to be imitators. Follow my example, Paul says, as I follow the example of Christ, 1 Corinthians 11:1. Similarly, Paul commends imitation to the Christians at Philippi. Join together in following my example, brothers and sisters, and just as you have us as a model, keep your eyes on those who live as we do, Philippians 3:17. Like a boy who learns to drive by mimicking what he sees his father doing, so we learn to put on the virtues by imitating those who model the Christ-like life. He says, this is part of the formative power of our teachers who model the Christian life for us. You that are teaching in this school next door have a tremendous opportunity to influence and to model for your students what it means to live the Christian life. And of course, as parents, we have a huge opportunity and responsibility to do that. The principle of imitation. Fourthly, the principle of investment. You are gaining, leveraging, maintaining, or squandering social and cultural capital. Those are the options open to us. And we talked about that at some length. As we look across the cultural landscape in the Western world, I think it's fairly safe to say, and not ugly, that the culture by and large out there, the broader culture, is basically socially, culturally, morally bankrupt. In fact, there's a book, several books, that would argue that we're now living in what's called the anti-culture, where everything is to be destroyed, everything is supposed to be torn down, no institutions, nothing of the past is to remain, all must be remade. We spoke of how when a group of people lives together well over the course of time, that tends to build and to accrue social and cultural capital, as Donald Crabill talks about in his book, The Riddle of Amish Culture. And so as we said, that's why people in groups that react against their upbringing, and maybe they have some good reasons for reacting, I'm not saying all reaction has no reason, but when they react, they tend to recede because they cut themselves off from that cultural capital that was available to them. And as John D. Martin has said, every group that comes out and tries to start something new has about 30 years to do something with the capital they've taken with them. If they don't start to cultivate and create new culture and capital, their group is going to simply acculturate and lose out. And that 30-year mark is probably a bit arbitrary for no good reason, but there is a bit of a generational element there, where the great and wonderful ideas of one generation have to pass on to the next generation, and there has to be some buy-in, to co-op my brother Robert's statement. There has to be buy-in for it to continue on as something enduring. Fifthly, the principle of integration, or the principle of paradox. Life is dynamic because we live in God-given tensions. Victor Lee Austin, he has a fairly academic work, what I've read of it so far, but interesting. He says, there's a difference between contradiction and paradox, and if we can grasp the difference, we will find many things, not just theological things, be easier to understand. A contradiction is something which simply cannot exist. It is a simultaneous assertion of X and not X in the exact same sense. It is a contradiction to say that an object is a circle and a square in exactly the same sense. Such an object cannot exist. Contradictions cannot exist, but paradoxes can exist. And in fact, many of them do. What we mean when we say something is a paradox is that we have reason to believe that some state of affairs exists which, nonetheless, we are not fully able to grasp. A paradox may look like a contradiction, but upon examination, one can find a reason to hold that it is not such, however puzzling it may remain. Human maturity entails the acceptance of paradox. And so here again, young people, if I might appeal to you a little more, part of growing up, and this is what Victor Lee Austin is saying, part of growing up and maturing is realizing there are things in life that look contradictory, but actually we need to hold them together. Because if we isolate one or the other, we lose both. Life and spiritual life are full of these paradoxes that we need to grapple with. Jesus as fully God and fully man. Sounds like a paradox. But they must be kept together. The importance of the individual and of the group. We dare not lose both of those. They must be held in tension. Keeping boundaries as a church, reaching out. There again, we must be an evangelical people in the sense of evangelizing, but we also must be a people who cultivate and keep that which has been passed on to us. I like what Andy Stanley says. I don't support a lot of his theological endpoints. But he has talked in a leadership podcast about how when we're making decisions and we're trying to solve problems, it's very important to consider the problem we're trying to solve. In this case, we're trying to deal with the matter of culture. Culture is a thing to deal with. And what he says is we need to ask ourselves the question, when we're faced with a problem or a question, we need to ask ourselves, is this a problem to solve? Or is this a tension to manage? Is this a problem to solve or a tension to manage? You know, a lot of people that have gone off with high hopes of doing something amazing and super spiritual thought they were solving a problem, but they were actually just solving for a little bit a tension. What he says is tensions don't get solved. They just come back again somehow. And so the group that feels like, and I'm sort of picking on people that are leaving the conservative group, but I love them very much, okay? So my concern is they feel that if somehow we could just get rid of some of these unnecessary things that are an impediment, then we can reach out better. They always find themselves up against having to decide whether or not to draw a line again. You can move the line, but you really can't get rid of the line. And that indicates the fact that this is not a problem. The questions that you're asking and you're raising, you're wrestling with as a brotherhood about standards of practice, is not a problem to solve. It's a tension to manage. Hopefully with that sort of mindset, that provides some encouragement, some hope. Because standards of practice, once adopted, won't cease to cause a problem. The tension will go on. It's okay. It's a part of the process of life and the paradoxes that we face. So we thought about these underappreciated practices, these undeveloped principles, and a third thing to consider is the untapped power. The untapped power. Ephesians 2, 1-3 is our text. When you look at the bookends of the text, in verses 1, 15 to 23, and then 2, 4 to 10, it speaks about the exceeding greatness of Jesus' power toward us who believe, far above all cultural currents. That's my translation. In verse 21, for good works which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. God doesn't put us in the world to keep us paralyzed. Uncertain of what to do, how to proceed, can I go forward? He gives us the overwhelming power that we need to go forward with the beautiful gospel of the King. And he does that through the power of his Holy Spirit. I want to encourage you with that. We have the power to stride through the current. And so, yes, I do want you to know that cultures have currents, and they are going somewhere, and so are you. But we have the power of Christ to help us to stride through those currents in a strong counter-current manner. In closing, we cannot entirely escape the currents of culture. But through the power of the Spirit, we can see a lot of what makes up those currents. We can stand strong in the midst of the pressures and the tensions. And yes, we can join with brothers and sisters to create a strong, enduring, countercultural countercurrent for King Jesus. I trust that'll be so for each one of our families and each one of our churches.